You're listening to Distraction Therapy with Rob Watson. Conversations about how we find meaning in our lives and what it's like to be part of a meta-modern world. Hello, it's Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson, and it's Saturday the 2nd of July. I'm joined again by Ryan Clayton.
Hello.
What have you been watching? We've had a conversation before we started, literally about what we're going to talk about, and we kind of got no idea. So we were thinking we must have been watching stuff and viewing stuff this week. So we're going to start off, which is something that we haven't normally done.
Yeah, we never talk about the TV shows that we've watched. It's always very academic.
Which is the kind of aim of what we were trying to do. Last time we had a kind of really extended metaphysical conversation, but it was this time we aimed to start at the bottom and add rather than subtract.
Yeah.
We're not starting at 100%, we're starting at zero today.
No, let's not delve straight into Sartre or Kant.
Well, you can do if you want to.
Yeah, what have I been watching? Not a lot. I've been reading a lot of just old, like, late 1980s Fantastic Four comic books. Ones that, to be perfectly honest, aren't very good, but that's mainly the reason I've been reading them. Come back from work, put on some Selena Gomez or some Taylor Swift and just absolutely mong out. I can see your face churning. Like,
I don't know who Selena Gomez is, but I know Taylor Swift is like pop.
Just
didn't strike me as the kind of music you're into.
Well, you know, bits and pieces. Sometimes a good bit of pop music to turn the brain off, distract yourself. I mean, that's the title of this podcast, isn't it? Distraction Therapy.
Yeah, quite.
Just a bit of pop music to have on in the background whilst you read some trashy comics. I find it quite cathartic.
I thought you'd be into like some kind of 1980s Japanese underground rock bands or something.
I'm just not that cultured, Rob. I don't know.
You've got the internet, haven't you?
I don't know how people find these things other than Googling.
YouTube.
Yeah, yeah. Other than Googling obscure 1980s Japanese rock band. I don't know how you'd come across that. So
I'm sure somebody has. There's probably some culture of, there's a comic shop in Tokyo somewhere that is dedicated to vintage comics that also has vintage rock music.
Oh, well, you and me, Rob, we're going to Tokyo then, obviously. next podcast, Ryan and Rob on the road, loose in Tokyo.
Yeah, with a very superficial view of what bands were there, most of them which were considered rubbish at the time. But
I mean, they hate us here, they're definitely going to hate us over there.
Yeah, you never know. We might have an audience out in Japan. So, big in Japan.
Maybe. Somehow I don't see it. But no, what else have I been watching?
Did you watch any Glastonbury?
Was it last weekend? I was in Lincolnshire to see a choir that my friend was in, and I drove back.
So you're not quite so uncultured then. What kind of choir was that?
It was, St. Peter's Singers. It wasn't overly religious, but you could tell that it was a church choir because the person who I went to see in the choir, her father is something like, I don't know. I don't know the correct term for it, but he's like
deacon or
God man. I don't know.
A vicar? A priest?
Yeah, he rules over, is it?
Bishop?
I don't know. He's got a Wikipedia page.
Oh, probably up there as kind
shall
of
we pull him up?
Bishopry, yeah.
But no,
I mean, you've probably just done him great insult after his many years of dedicated service to the church.
I spoke to him as well and he was a dead nice bloke, and now here I am demeaning all of his
he's probably got an interest in 1980s Japanese rock music. And we're getting buzzing from your phone, so that's better.
There we go. See, this is what people listen for. Former British Anglican priest, current Dean of Peterborough. Oh,
Dean.
Yeah, Dean. So, but anyway, that was nice. And when I got back, the only bit of Glastonbury I caught was, I don't know, the arse end of Paul McCartney's set. And I was honestly surprised at how dreadful Paul McCartney is.
But he is 80.
Yeah, but he just needs to stop.
There's two camps. My nephew went to see it, and he went specifically to see Paul McCartney, and he was down at the front. And he was he's like 21, I think, and he was on the TV a couple of times.
You know, oh, really?
Singing along and stuff like that. And I was asking my sister, you know, kind of why he wasn't monged out, because that's what people go to Glastonbury for. And he goes, his body's a temple. So, and then he came back. I think he came back the next day, so he didn't even stay to see any of the other bands. So.
No, I was. I don't know. I was surprised because it was mostly just all old Beatles songs.
Well, yeah, that's what the crowd wants. 200,000 people stood in a field. He can't get away with playing obscure Wings B-sides.
No, but his voice just isn't. It's not up to it anymore.
For 80, I think he did one of the best performances he's done for a while.
Well, if you put it that way, for 80, he's doing all right. Yeah, but the amount of money he must have, he could retire.
But I think he just enjoys playing. You know, there was the bit where I don't know if we saw Dave Grohl and Bruce Springsteen come on, and there was a real kind of sense of joy that they were playing together. They, you know, they loved it. It was just, you know, one of those moments. It's kind of give the crowd what they want kind of thing. And it was, you know, it can be cathartic to sing a lot. But it was interesting that the crowd is full of 20-somethings as well as, so, you know, he's been going for 50, 60 years.
Well, I suppose that kind of music, you know, like the Beatles, it's amongst younger people, it catches on because I feel like younger people hear it and they're like, oh yeah, I'm so different. I'm listening to the Beatles and not, you know, whatever Harry Styles has brought out this week or something. I mean, it's good music, so fair enough, but...
Yeah, it's just don't over deify it. I think that's the thing, you know, it is pop tunes that are meant to be pop tunes.
Yeah.
Not some kind of religious text.
Especially the early Beatles stuff is my favourite, when they're so unapologetically a boy band.
Yeah.
And it's all like very poppy, like, what's the one, like hold your hand.
Well, George Martin called that their bubblegum phase.
Yeah, and I think that stuff's great.
Yeah.
Because you can just, my least favourite Beatles album is the White Album. Because I don't know.
We'll just go on a bit.
Yeah, it goes on a bit. Isn't that the one as well? Is it Revolution Number 9 that's on it?
Yeah. And I just... There's like a 15-minute soundscape on it.
Yeah, maybe I'm exposing myself for being...
Nobody ever listens to Revolution Number 9. You listen to it and then you kind of... the next time you play the album, you skip through it, you know.
Yeah, I heard it and I genuinely didn't understand what was going on and the point behind it, but...
Well, they did that, you know. People think they were just a bubblegum band, but they weren't. They were, you know, relatively, to use a horrible phrase, avant-garde at the time. You know, they prided themselves on being at that kind of, at, you know, the edge of popular music rather than.
And some of the weirdest stuff
leading from the edge, is that possible? Yeah.
Yes, I get. Well, I mean, I guess they did, didn't they? So they changed music in a lot of ways. But yeah, some of their weirdest stuff is still quite good. Like the, is it Octopus's Garden and Maxwell's Silver Hammer? That stuff's still great.
Well, it's funny. Yeah, I mean, it's like they're the ones that John Lennon hated. What was it, Maxwell's Silver Hammer? You know, it was the one in the Let It Be film that kind of almost broke them up because they were being fastidious about recording and stuff like that. And but then they're the ones, but you know, John Lennon called it Paul's granny music. But then when they asked, you know, the partner, you know, they were with the partners and the wives and girlfriends and stuff, saying, what should we put on the album? They wanted it on because it goes, you know, you need both.
Yeah.
You can't just have John Lennon's She's So Heavy, you know, 15-minute heavy metal track. You know, they invented heavy metal with that track kind of thing. And you can't just have that one track, you know, of John's rock stuff. You've got to have the mixture of things.
But. Yeah, because it really helps break it up, I feel like, when you're listening to one of those albums. Like, you know, you've got, what is it? Is it Come Together that starts off, and then suddenly you're listening to Something, which is like overly romantic. Yeah. And then I think it shifts into Maxwell's Silver Hammer, and it's like...
Well, that's the dynamic.
Constantly,
you know, it's
thrown for a loop.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. You know, I wonder, I listen to a lot of pop music these days, and I've reached the age where it all sounds the same. So one of the things watching the audience, kind of watching it on TV, and there wasn't a lot that I watched because I don't know a lot of who the artists are now.
Yeah.
They just don't mean anything to me. I barely know who Kendrick Lamar is. I've no idea.
Well, I'm not entirely
so,
sure.
So to see the crowd singing along, knowing all the words, it's like kind of... Who are these people?
Yeah,
I, you know, I'm living on a different planet now, and that's like a, you know, it moves. Popular culture moves so quickly and in such small, tight knit groups that you know you get a.
Yeah. I mean, and if you're not in that group, you'll miss it.
Yeah,
and that's it. And then, then it's so hard to get back into it again, because before you know it, there's just so much
and
to listen
if,
to.
It's like, you know, I get embarrassed for people my age who still only go on about their Madonna record collection from the 90s. You know, it's like, kind of, oh, well, I like getting home and having a nice bop to 80. You know, they only listen to radio stations with music from the 80s. Mm. And it's like, but that music was rubbish at the time, and it's still rubbish now. Why have you not grown with your musical choice and taste? Now, I'm not saying I'm any better. You know, I still listen to Pet Shop Boys were on at the weekend, so I listened to, I watched them. And that was quite interesting, because at the beginning, the staging didn't work. They had this screen that was supposed to rise up, and it didn't. So Neil Tennant had to come out at the front and stand in front of this screen.
Mm.
And next to him was supposed to be Chris Lowe on a keyboard. And the keyboard's there, and it's like everybody go. I could see, I've got onto Twitter to see what's happening. Have they had an argument? Has there been a you know, is somebody ill or something like that? There was no way that they were going to say he was at another keyboard be in the back of the stage, which was supposed to be revealed later, and he'd go up there later in the set. But instead, so they had to he just went on that. But it was like really freaky, because you're so used to seeing them as a duo stood there together, that for one of them to be absent and to just have Neil Tennant stood there singing was like, hang on, this is, your world was destabilized for a moment, you know. It's like, it's bright, what's going on? What's going on? And then eventually, you know, a couple of songs in, the thing gets raised, and they, you know, it kind of carries on as normal. And it's like, okay, that's interesting, you know. But for somebody who's so, who just stands there, you know, plays the keyboard with sunglasses on usually, and doesn't do much in terms of, doesn't do anything in terms of performance, and yet is such an integral part of that dynamic of the way they perform.
Well, I suppose that's part of the brand as well, isn't it? That's the image that you're used to. And like you say, when that image is disrupted in some way, it does throw you for a loop a little bit, because you don't know what to expect. This thing that was so familiar to you is now different.
Yeah, it's like, you know, that's why people find it difficult to move on, I suppose. Mm. You know, and there's a lot of people, you know, when you follow people's reactions, I mean, the Pet Shop Boys have released something like 12 studio albums, something like that. And people think that they stopped making popular music in the mid 90s, but no, they've carried on, and they've made more post than mid-90s than they had done prior to that.
Yeah.
But you get this impression, because somebody doesn't see them, you know, on a regular basis, or doesn't follow them, that they, you know, it's like, you know, who knew that I mean, at one point Depeche Mode were like the biggest band on the planet, but nobody in this country knew about it, because we weren't following them, we weren't in tune with them, and people weren't going to their big massive sold out concerts in arenas in America.
I don't even know who that is, Rob.
It just shows you, doesn't it? So culture's a fickle thing. It comes and it goes, and we think that what we experience as popular culture is the most important thing, when really it's just flotsam.
And you're right as well, like, you know, people experience things at a certain time in their life when they're like primed to receive those things well, and it sticks. Like Star Wars is a good example. You know,
talking about Star Wars again.
I know how different of us, but you experience it, and then it sticks with you, and it becomes this comfortable thing. And even though popular culture kind of grows outside of that, and now, like, I mean, science fiction, there's so much more out there than just Star Wars, but people have become comfortable with it to the degree that they never really grow with popular culture. So as a result, we're in this weird phase where popular culture seems to almost be catering to that lack of growth with the, like, the Kenobi thing.
Circling around itself a bit.
Yeah.
Did you watch Kenobi?
I didn't know. I've seen a lot of the the stuff on Twitter and that with what's his name, actor that plays Anakin Skywalker coming back to do, you know, Darth Vader again, and the flashback scenes, and Liam Neeson being back again as Qui-Gon Jinn, but nothing.
So
I've
you've just given
it.
All the spoilers away for anybody who might have been...
Just thrown them all out there, because I don't care about it, Rob, so nobody else should. That's the levels that my narcissism has reached.
I'm just trying to order some more coffee on the thingy. Let me. I need to empty the basket. Oops.
It's quite interesting actually sitting here and watching technophobe Rob
struggle with his
iPhone.
The rubbish app that they've got, which is for some reason, I know they're about to change it again. So let me just put. I'm just gonna put the table number in. Yes, continue with order.
This is great advertisement for this place.
I'm here though. Let's try this.
All the time, I see you posting on Twitter coffee. with your coffee and your poor loads.
Please fix your internet. You know, everybody. You know, just do not throttle back your internet. We're beyond that. We're not in the 1990s. You know, this is 2022. Yeah.
This will be the rest of the podcast now.
High-speed internet access is no longer an exception. It's got to be the norm. Please catch up with it. We're in the second decade, third decade. What decade are we in?
Of the internet.
The third decade of the century. Noughties, teenies, third decade.
Yeah,
beginning of the
right.
third decade of the 21st century. And you've got an upload speed of less than a quarter of a megabyte per second.
I always think it's hilarious.
I remember thinking that was great in 1996, you know.
I don't know, Rob, I always think it's hilarious. I see these things pop up and I'm like, oh, here's Rob raging against the machine once again.
The app doesn't seem to be letting me buy anything today, so we'll have to wait. We'll have another coffee afterwards.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay.
I think we're probably, by the sounds of it, I think we're caffeinated and delirious enough.
Yeah, one will do. Given our track record of having too much caffeine in the past. So.
Yeah, one more and we'll end up in the cant territory again.
No, please.
Nobody needs to chat about transcendental idealism again. Oh, my goodness.
Well, kind of you want. So you didn't watch Kenobi. I didn't watch Kenobi.
To be honest,
I don't think you missed a lot. To be honest with you, it was a bit like you got the action figures out to play and you arranged them on the table.
Yeah,
and you did that. Wasn't really. I thought Ewan McGregor was good. I thought Hayden Christensen.
Well, Ewan McGregor's
okay.
just a great actor anyway. I think he's good in most things that he's in.
Yeah.
It just depends on the script that he's given a lot of the time.
It was just a bit kind of like play set stuff sometimes. Yeah. It's confirming what you know, which you know, getting the things out of the toy box and having another go at this, you know, redoing the story, which is fine. You know, it's like it was entertaining and stuff. Yeah. But we watched it's 2.5 hours long, so you can only watch one episode in one evening.
Right.
The Stranger Things.
I heard about that. Yeah.
Which I think there's 9 episodes in total in this season, so they've just released the last 2. So
that seems like a strange release model for a TV season.
Record, seen in the paper this morning, the record number of streams for any TV show. So they've got it right in terms of building that anticipation. Yeah.
Well, people seem to be almost...
Quite dull storytelling, to be honest with you.
Really?
That's right, I wasn't so interested.
I've heard a lot of really good things, not about these 2 episodes in particular, but about just the show in general and this latest season.
Good. It's good.
People almost seem pissed off when I tell them I've not seen it. Like, I've sat there and stabbed their puppy.
You've got to take out a subscription for all of these things. It's like, how many subscriptions can you have for stuff that, you know, I've got a pile of books that I want to read and Taylor Swift albums to get through.
Well, exactly.
Isn't she
it.
The one that keeps re-recording her old albums because she fell out with the record company?
Yeah, that's the one. I've not heard that. I've got one of her albums on my phone and it's very much like bubblegum pop stuff. So I've not heard, because some of that stuff is, I mean, I respect it from a level of like artistry to be able to like reclaim your own music and like do these massively extended versions, but also at the same time I'm not sitting there and listening to a 15 minute long Taylor Swift song. You can forget it.
Well, I am guilty. I mean, the Beatles reissues, the Roxy Music reissues when they come along, hearing and noting the remastered versions can, but you've got to be really kind of focused on that piece of music.
I think you've got to be really interested, haven't you, for it to have any kind of effect on you. Like, because I didn't listen to the music when it first came out, and I'm not a huge fan. It's just something I like to have on because it's quite pleasant, like you said, bubblegum pop that you can distract yourself to, and is quite enjoyable. It's just, it doesn't hold the same effect for me.
I've always struggled with, struggle's the wrong word, isn't it? Because it's hardly a struggle, is it? You know, but in terms of, one, I haven't got a very good memory and ability to recall names of things that I'm listening to and know the genres and stuff like that. I can't have one of those sophisticated conversations about music. I don't read, mainly because I've got had friends in the past who, you know, would devour Mojo magazine and would tell you all the differences between, I don't know, Pink Floyd's back albums in the 60s and The Doors and all that kind of stuff and Velvet Underground. They know all the differences between them. Whereas for me, it's like just a bit like information overload of something which is very, it's there. And if I want to look it up, I'll look it up, but it's not like...
Well, I think as well, like, music in particular, there are people that are very, very into it, which again is fair enough. But then for a lot of people, it's just... It's something that more so exists in the background, isn't it? You listen to it when you're walking somewhere, or you go home, you relax, you put on one of your favourite albums, and very few people, I think, really put on an album then just sit there and listen to it.
That says a lot of people. When I was an undergraduate, there were a lot of people who would go to their fan club or whatever, you know, the student union, and they would be specifically there on the night that played, say, indie music and something like, I don't know, some. I'm trying to remember the names, you know, kind of, this is in the mid 90s, so you know, you'd get Blair or somebody, Oasis or whatever, it had come up, and they would be there, and that would define their night of having that dance around. Whereas you've taken it then from what you've just said that wasn't you.
No, that wasn't me. I mean, for a brief period it was, when I was like, you know, when I had very long hair and I was very interested in heavy metal, but ever since, I've just, you know, I like music. I feel like everybody likes music.
But there's different ways to like music, isn't there? You know, it's like as you say, there's the bubblegum disposable pop kind of music, which has its virtues. But I think what I find is that music is the one thing that we've got where you can actually engage in an aesthetic experience without being admonished about it, about being kind of you're not kind of, people, it doesn't matter, people respect, everybody has a different taste in music, but at the same time, you know, so something like, you know, there's lots of tents at Glastonbury, lots of places, you know, venues in Glastonbury that play music which is very, you know, left field and, or, you know, kind of way off the there's an idea that most people who go to Glastonbury go to see the big headline acts, and it's not true. There's a lot of people go, a significant number, probably 50%, go to see the smaller, obscure things, where you might be sitting there listening to 20 minutes of Mongolian goat herding choirs, you know, throat music or whatever it is, you know, that kind of, and that eclecticism is something that has defined British popular culture, or used to define it, and I'm not so sure it's there anymore in many ways.
Yeah, I'm not so... Maybe in the terms that you're describing it, of perhaps still in music, because like you say, you know, nobody's really... Well, I mean, people are admonished for having different tastes in music, but it's never in a serious way. But when you look at, like, the films and stuff that come out, they're all very similar. There isn't the same eclectic nature to, like, film.
Yeah, they've homogenised around the centre. Yeah. Some kind of quasi-symphonic score in the middle with a bit of electronics occasionally, and You know, the most that you get is Danny Elfman or somebody like that doing something a little bit particularly obscure. Or
it's all based around what works, isn't it? To be fair, like it all feels very churned out by a system or a computer that's like, oh, well, this was really successful in this film, so let's do something like that. And then everything just sort of starts to become grey over time. Like, I mean, when was the last time you went to one of those Marvel films and was really blown away by the music in it?
Well, given that you haven't seen Stranger Things, what did you think of Kate Bush running up the hill, getting to number one in the singles chart, the download charts?
I was bemused by it, to be honest, because I've heard that Kate Bush is really good, and that she was quite interesting and almost avant-garde. But then I listened to that song and I just thought it was a bit
rubbish.
Yeah, I couldn't get behind it. It must be because of the way that it's used in the TV show. That's the only thing I can take away from that. There's got to be some kind of emotional or like cathartic meaning behind the song and the way that it's used in the show that's made it popular, that I'm just not connecting with, because I listened to the song and thought, this isn't good.
Just mid-80s.
Yeah, this is rubbish.
It's good. It's a good. I think, surprisingly, out of all the kind of, if you look at, Hall & Oates and who was big at the time, Bon Jovi and all that kind of stuff, Kate Bush songs, carry on. They stand the test of time. Mm. There's some integrity to them. But she was writing pop music of its time.
Yeah.
It's not meant to be. I mean, it can be enduring and long-lasting, but it's...
Well, it obviously has been, so... But I don't know. I guess that's also a part of the... It's a period piece, isn't it, Stranger Things? Isn't it set in the 80s? Yeah, so I guess if you're looking for music like that for the 80s, like diegetic music for characters to be, stuff that they would genuinely be listening to in the 80s, you're going to have to mine that kind of... popular vein of 80s music, aren't you? And I guess by the time you've gone through, what is it now, 4 seasons of television, you're probably going to run out of the stuff that like everybody can reel off and everybody knows.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, perhaps everybody does know Kate Bush and I didn't know who she was.
It is a bit like, kind of people lionize stuff, and it's like, the 80s was really great. And it's like, it wasn't, it was terrible. Most of the music choice at the time,
life's always terrible.
Well, no, but I mean, it's like, people have a nostalgia for these things as if it was somehow better than it was. And actually, I watched, we watched the Queen movie. I think it's on Netflix or something.
The biopic
about Freddie Mercury.
Oh, I thought you meant Queen as in Elizabeth.
That's the rock band one. Yeah. They finally got around to watching that. For some reason, that made nearly $800 million at the box office.
Oh, wow.
On its minuscule budget.
Yeah.
And again, it was one of those things of, this kind of... Yeah, the annoying thing about Queen is that they're detestable, but they do have catchy tunes. And, But there was a kind of, hey, weren't the 80s, kind of...
What's interesting as well is that sometimes a lot of that nostalgia comes from people that were born after the 80s had ended and were dead and buried.
The interesting thing that people kind of find difficult to get used to now, people of my generation, is where your generation's nostalgia comes from. So, it's reinventing the noughties or something like that. So it's like 2 decades later. So in the 90s, the 70s were big.
Yeah.
So in the noughties, the 80s were, but supposedly that kind of thing, it comes and goes. But there's always a wave of nostalgia, and as we always say, nostalgia isn't what it used to be. So you always have this. Nobody ever laughs at that.
I didn't realise it was a joke.
Yeah. No, nobody ever does. But you have this idea, kind of reappropriation of, your parents' record collection.
I've just got the joke.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't have said anything. Yeah. I won't be able to try that one again in public.
Tell you what, next podcast we'll see if we'll I laugh it. Then, yeah, because yeah. I'll have forgotten.
I just keep saying the same joke. Yeah. How many jokes have you got, Rob? Oh, two. Maybe not even that. Yeah. No. So that's nostalgia done.
Yeah.
So what else have you done?
Mind
looking
that.
At reading. What have you bought any new comic books? That's always a good. Any new books?
Interesting question. I feel like I've had less time for stuff like that now that I've now that I have to drive in and out of work and
you've had to buy a car.
Yeah.
So you've gone over to the dark side.
I know.
Next you'll be looking at mortgages.
Oh jeez.
Next you'll be free life of youth. It's all going to be subsumed into LinkedIn profiles and professional training and
you're definitely
middle management.
Definitely trying to get a rise out of me right now. But
I'm just telling you what's ahead of you for the next 20 years.
I've never felt so depressed. That's incredible. What's amazing as well is that I work with people who are not substantially younger than me, but I suppose when you're in your 20s, it seems like a reasonable difference, but who are like, there's one girl that I work with who's 21 and she's currently in the process of buying her second house.
Wow.
So bought a house and is now in the process of selling that one and buying a new one.
Gosh.
And I just think at 21.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing with my life at 21, let alone willing to commit to a mortgage with a long-term, partner. It's just it's outstanding.
Scary, isn't it?
Yeah. Like you were saying earlier before we started recording, the degree to which all of that, the foolishness of youth just gets sort of sanded away until before you know it, you're 21 years old with a mortgage and you're involved in property chains.
Yeah, I suppose if you want to have kids and things like that, that's what you've got to do these days. You used to be able to do it where you could rent until you were 30 or something, and you could start a family because it was cheap enough to rent. But all of that's out the window now. Yeah. So
it's actually quite refreshing when I meet people who are 26 and are equally destitute
inadequate,
their lives are equally
socially
as
dissolved,
their lives are equally as catastrophic
precarious,
as mine. Precarious.
Just, it's when you meet people in their 50s and they're still in that same position. That's what worries me. you should have had two mortgages and six kids. You should be on your grandkids now. And you should have had five cars, and it's like none of that.
No, it's mental. And then there's another guy there who's 23 and has recently bought a home, and I'm just thinking, oh great, so you've got a mortgage now and a girlfriend that you've been with for 6 years. Well, that's great. I've not been able to keep a relationship for longer than two.
But you've read loads of books, which is going to be more important in the end.
Well, I suppose one gets you laid more. The books don't.
The house.
House and the steady girlfriend.
You've got a family.
Yeah. But I don't know. I just think it's very strange how, you see some people, and not even necessarily in a negative way. I'm going to stop being judgmental for a second, but I know, but how different some people's values and priorities are. You meet people and you think, you're about the same age as me, a couple of years younger, a couple of years older, it doesn't really matter. And then there's just, there's like a disconnect of lived experience. Like I always tell people the story about the time I got my jaw broken in half by travellers. And they just look at me like, what kind of life are you leading? And I was like, what do you mean, what kind of life? I thought this happened to everybody, does it not? And it's just, I just think it's wild that some people live, quite frankly, very tedious lives.
Well, the extreme now, to be a non-conformist, if you like, to be a conformist is very obviously it's very common.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of comfortable.
But it's easy, isn't it?
I don't know. I mean, not from everybody I talk to. It's quite tough and difficult to maintain that, because the one thing that you've got to do is you've got to knuckle down at work.
Well,
and
yeah.
You can't express any kind of opinion or have any kind of individuality. What you're there to do is to conform to the...
Let me tell you, Rob, suppressing your personality and individuality, it gets easier. Don't worry about it.
Well, I don't think I've ever really been able to do that.
Yeah. We'll make a drone out of you yet, Rob.
I think I'm past those days. I've been through that process and spat out the other side.
Well, here I am, still sat in my work clothes with my buttoned-up shirt.
Yes. Explaining how you commute to the office.
Yeah.
In the suburbs of a mid-sized city in an East Midlands conobation.
Genuinely.
And at lunchtime, you can drive to the local out-of-town shopping centre to look at household.
I'm trying very hard to pinpoint the exact moment my life became this tedious.
When you learn to drive, I'd say. Well, drive. I mean, the interesting thing is driving is seen as this kind of great... thing of, you know, symbol
liberator,
of freedom,
liberator. Almost, yeah.
And I've always avoided it, probably to my detriment, because, you know, there's so many things. I can't just jump in the car this weekend and go up to the Peak District or something like that, which is a shame, and I do regret that. But at the same time, it's saved me from a life of drudgery of working in an industrial estate on the edge of a city.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it.
Traveling to meetings,
because
doing PowerPoint presentations.
I'll tell you. I mean, as you know, last night I was on a date and she asked me about my life and what I do, and I was telling her. And I sat there.
I hope you said podcasting is at the top of my.
Well, I didn't want to brag too much, Rob. You see, I didn't want to let her know that I'm actually quite a big deal, but.
In the underground podcast scene.
to the two people that are probably... No, who am I kidding? Nobody's listening to this.
They'll tweet you.
Yeah. No, they won't.
Not even your family.
Yeah, no, not even my dad listens to this, probably. God bless him if he does. He must be bored out of his mind when he's doing it. But it's just, you know, I was sitting there and she asked me about my life and I was telling her and I was like, oh, you know, I've got an office job, I commute to the office. She's like, oh, what's the most fun thing that's happened in the office? And my response was genuinely, well, yesterday we had no tie Thursday afternoons. And I just, listening to the words coming out of my mouth, thinking, God, when did I become
You're going to
this?
Be wallpaper soon, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, when did I become
you're
this walking, horribly you're tedious
the,
person?
Walk into the room and there'll be just, you know, bland people stood against a wall that you won't be able to distinguish the difference between magnolia-coloured wallpaper.
I did suggest to my boss that... we should have a Todgers Out Tuesdays, but she didn't seem to go for that.
I think you have to leave that for the Conservative MPs.
Yeah.
They're in charge of that department at the moment. You know, so.
It's all fun and games, isn't it, until your soul gets destroyed?
Well, I suppose, you know, you have to do what you can to survive, and then you move away from it.
Well, that's the thing that's always bothered me. I was, for a long period of time, you know, since being a student all the way up to basically getting this job, chronically broke, never had any money for anything, you know, not really able to do much as a result other than sit there and read. And I always thought, God, one day I'll have money and I'll be able to do things. I've just got to get a job. And that was, you know, always pushing to that next step to get there. And now that I'm here, and I mean, I don't get paid a lot, but now that I've got a little bit of money, it's like, I look back on those days of being chronically broke, having nowhere to go and nothing to do, with like nostalgia, like, oh, wasn't that great? All the reading I got done, all of the self-development
that I did. What happens is you start to, it's like a psychopomp. What you do is you have to start to live out the life that goes with that status and that income. So you add, you know, you start saying, well, we've got a joint income of this. We need to be going to these kind of places, or we need to go on holiday with friends to this kind of place. And it ratchets up, and before you know it, the £3,000 before or after tax income that you get actually isn't enough to live on.
No.
Whereas when you were when you were skint and you were living on £800 a month or something like that, then that's actually more liberating. But the other thing that's the big problem is that, and it is a curse of modern life, if you like, is the constant sense that something good is always happening somewhere else.
Yeah.
And actually, when you this is one of the challenges of living in Leicester, which has got one of the lowest levels
nothing good ever happens.
Well, I mean, it's partly because, or the perception of that is, it's got a low level. It's the second lowest, according to the Resolution Foundation this week, the city with the second lowest level of disposable income.
Mm.
I think Manchester's next, and then Nottingham is third. But Leicester's second, so it means that there isn't, it's people don't spend money on books and going to the cinema as much, and
yeah.
But there's also an idea that, well, why would you spend your money in this city? You want to be doing that somewhere else. There are better places to achieve your aim of having this fantasy life.
Yeah, well, it's crazy the amount of people I know that hold those kind of values, and they're just not here anymore because they've gone to London, and that's where they are. You'll always talk to people who've, everybody's got a member of their family that's in London because they moved there for the job and the money, and they're there and they're still broke
because you have to live the London lifestyle, and everything costs more, and there's more to do, and there's
it's mental. My friend at work, his brother is a huge deal on TikTok, like millions of followers, he must make a lot of money from it, and it was telling me that he's because of the kind of people that he hangs out with and the kind of lifestyle that he has, he still never has any money.
Yeah,
and I think he's got a job as well as doing TikTok. So that's just, I mean, that's crazy to me that you could be quote unquote wealthy and successful and still not have any money.
Well, you end up, it's like you end up chasing, your energy is purely there to pay other people.
Mm.
So what you do in any income that you get is you passing on to other people.
Yeah.
You certainly do that kind of freelance creative industry stuff. By and large, you don't retain anything yourself.
Mm.
There's very little that you actually end up holding on to, because you've got to network, you've got to look good, you've got to buy clothes, you've got to know what's going on in the culture.
Me when you said look good. That felt nice.
Well, we're in Leicester, the standards are quite low.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I'm not letting you off in that one. I mean, at least you're not in your usual kind of camping attire. So
yeah.
But not that I'm a master of sartorial elegance or anything like that. So please, any criticisms, please write them on a postcard and put them in the bin.
But I will do. They'll go in the complaints box.
Maybe that's one of the next days that you can have at work. Badly dressed Friday, and people just come in as normal. What did you come as? I came as a really badly dressed office worker. Yeah. Oh, you've done it wonderfully. At some point you can't, it's the level of expectation just becomes so suffocating that all you can do is parody it.
Yeah.
Or be ironic or sarcastic about it. And it's the coping mechanism for that kind of routinization of this kind of, as you say, you see people on LinkedIn that clearly are often inadequate in their job, and yet have these amazing titles for jobs that they've kind of plucked from somewhere. It's like, so all of a sudden they're the director of this, that, the other, and you know them as the junior office worker who was incredibly lazy and never turned up on time, but now is somehow presenting themselves with a super polished CV, and you think,
just everything on LinkedIn is absolutely just rubbish. I mean, people all sit there. I was on it, as I was telling you, I was on it whilst you went to the toilet, and it's just like some of the stuff that people post on there and the massive paragraphs they write about their achievements, and it's like, just
I would describe it as Facebook for office people.
Yeah.
It's like a way of saying, look at me, I've just visited, I don't know.
It's just annoying because it feels like you say, like it's like, oh, look how successful I am. And then they start measuring their success by things that are totally meaningless. Like, 50 years from now, who's going to care what office you worked in and what your job title was and how many press releases you churned out? It's totally instrumental to doing, you know, to living your life.
Well, it's like you may as well be a prison warden.
Yeah.
You know, how many times did you walk up and down the corridor? How many times did you jangle your keys? How many times did you open the doors? Nobody's interested. Did you reform any prisoners? No. They just went out and then came back in again because they were unreformed. You know, and it's that process. It's like a carousel of just churning the same things in and out, and nothing really changes. You know, and LinkedIn is the perfect. It is like, you know, you can imagine it's the merry-go-round. You go to the fun fair and everybody's maybe on a different ride, but they're all just waving at you saying, look at me, I'm on this ride. Isn't it amazing that I'm on the log flume?
Yeah.
Oh, hang on a minute, I'm on the cups that go right, you know, the kiddies cups things or whatever it is, and you're thinking, this is pointless.
I know.
It's just we all turn up at this fun fair for the day, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and then leave at 5 o'clock and go, hey, we've done something useful when we haven't.
It's crazy to me as well, the degree to which people allow and let stuff like that to totally define them. And it becomes their life to the point where there's nothing outside of that. You know, I imagine there are some people, and I wish I could name names, but I'm not going to, that I can imagine just going home and sitting there in a dark room
watching Emmerdale and EastEnders,
not even that, just staring into the darkness, not moving until the sun rises again, and then they simply stand back up and go to work again. And it's like, that's because there's just nothing there beyond the PR.
Well, and we live in a, I don't know whether it, we live in a cultureless world where everything is disposable, or, you know, it's down to your personal taste. There's no commonality in terms of what would you say if the fun fair, you know, if the amusement park, theme park was burning down, would you save any of it? This whole, you know, kind of the culture of professional routine, is there anything that is worth passing on to the next generation? Or should we just say, hang on a minute, let's stop doing this because it's pointless? You know, how many more project managers do we need? How many more liaison assistants do we need? How many more PAs do we need? Are you actually doing anything that makes any difference to any part of human society? Does anybody get any pleasure? Sitting in a coffee shop, good coffee brings pleasure to people. Like a restaurant, well-cooked food, which is done with care and passion. You know, people who live in, work in the caring professions and medical professions, there's a purpose there that you can take pride in. But press releases and module handbooks for courses that, you know, nobody is really interested in, just don't add anything to the whole sum of human progress.
I mean, you could go so far as to say they actually actively subtract something from it, to be perfectly honest. Every day I sit there and I think to myself, yep, making the world a little bit worse.
So you,
every day
you're at the centre, the locus of nihilism, of the nihilistic society. You want to be taking notes about this. In years to come, people will be buying your novella about your experience of the deathly dread of working in an East Midlands,
and then burning it and throwing eggs at me, most likely.
No, you'll be sat in Paris kind of just sitting there smoking and drinking red wine and having arguments with people about existentialism and stuff like that. And they'll be telling you this stuff's so 1960s. It's like, why are you going on about all of this?
You know what, it would be nice, but I just, you know, especially now, it feels like the jaws of this city and this way of living are slowly clasping around me to the point where, you know, My legs have been cut off. I'm lying there.
You need to be shocked out of this. Is this what you need?
I need to be shot is what needs to happen. Yeah. I don't need to be shocked. I just need to be put out my misery, obviously.
We've only had one coffee as well.
Yeah.
So have you taken solace in anything that you've been reading, or what gives you a crumb of comfort in this bereft world of meaninglessness?
Yeah, Jesus. Like I said, I've been reading Sartre, which has been, you know, one part depressing, two parts slightly liberating. You know, trying. In some small ways to take control of my own existence. And like I said, I've been reading a lot of just pulp fiction, really, like pulp 1980s Fantastic Four comics, just because there's such a pulpy science fiction element to those things that's just...
I've been listening back to some work I've been doing, which is some recordings with some people that we went over to Norfolk with, went to Norwich the other week, and what was really fascinating about listening back to some of the interviews, met up with them again on Tuesday, listened to some interviews, just asking them to recount what they recalled from the thing, and I was listening back to it, is what they enjoyed about the experience wasn't it was what they wanted, needed and would have liked was, if you like a symbolic experience,
right?
That's what's missing. So they live in places like Milton Keynes and Birmingham and Leicester, and it's devoid of a sense that there is a participative symbolic culture that you can be part of. So it's like, if you're into fantasy, so one of the things, we went to Norwich Cathedral, and automatically they've got a cloisters, and I asked the tour guide, is this a common thing? Does the place get mistaken for the Harry Potter stuff? And he said, well, that was Gloucester Cathedral, not Norwich Cathedral. But yes, you know, a lot of people assume, and they've got a lectern, which is in the form of it's supposed to be a flamingo or something like that, but it's really weirdly described. It looks a lot more like the phoenix out of Harry Potter,
right?
That kind of thing. Very, you know, ornate thing. But people, what we tend to do is we tend to give people information. So the museums are very much about guiding people through the information.
Yeah.
Whereas actually what the instinctive response of the people who are there to, you know, going through this experience, in inverted commas, was that they were engaged in, they wanted to be submerged in the symbolic, mythological kind of,
right.
Point of this, that it was about being initiated into a sense that there's a way of imagining how culture is seen and can operate.
Mm.
Because most of what we do revolves around a kind of sense of, well, you pay your money, you get an economic transaction or an experience that's been designed for you. And it's very much one way, you know, here's your opportunity to take a photo, here's your opportunity to try on some hats, and it's very much, but they enjoyed it best when they could submerge themselves in a narrative, in a story.
Right.
And it's kind of what, you know, the contrast between that and what you describe and about the, you know, the dull routine of work and life, seems to be, well, actually, go, you know, we maybe need to go the other way, and there's no mythological quest there for anybody. There's no real purpose other than making money.
And
enabling other people to make money.
Well, that's what everything ultimately becomes subsumed under. It's just nothing has value or is valuable or worth your time unless it makes you money. To the point where there's more and more a push to attempt to monetize your hobbies and stuff on social media, to the point where, like, nothing can ever really just be yours to be lived and experienced and enjoyed. Everything has to be this slave to that constant drive towards capital.
Yeah.
Yeah, depressing.
So what's your response to it?
To be honest.
How do you try and cope with it other than go out and get incredibly drunk or something?
Well, that's one way. I don't know how I deal with it, to be fair. I think the way I deal with it is to just, it's almost to compartmentalize it, to say, look, yes, you know, I do have to have this job because I want money for various things. I want to be able to buy the comic books I want to buy, to be able to read them, to go see the films that I want to see, to pay for the 7 different subscription services so I can watch what's on TV, you know, whatever it is. And then, all right, 5:30 now, day's over, that's behind me, switch off. What am I going to do with my life?
Sitting down in a dark room.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Just waiting for the PR to start again the next day.
And then occasionally do a podcast.
Yeah. And what's depressing is that, you know, there's all this stuff that I want to do, all this stuff that I want to read, write, experience, enjoy, people I want to see. And then you shave off so much of your time to have the money to do those things that, you know, you get basically few hours at the end of a weekday, but often you're quite tired, and then you get the weekend and that's it.
I heard a really great comment in a podcast the other day, and it might have been the I can't remember which one it was. It might have been the Jason Smith one, the digital young one, and it was... that expectation that we can better ourselves is a form of power or empowerment. And that hunger or drive or will to increase knowledge and awareness is a basic energy, to use a general term, which shapes our lives, and which is an indication of what is propelling us forward. What I find confounding is when people get to the point where they don't feel like they need to know anything else, that there is nothing else to learn, or that they're not the kind of person that can be learning anything else.
Yeah.
So I'd rather be hungry for learning and dissatisfied than satisfied with my not learning anything.
Yeah.
One is even worse than, you know, death. The other is really annoying when you have to live through it, but it's actually, that's the drive to having a better life and a better understanding of how life operates. The other thing I heard the other day
that was uncharacteristically optimistic of you, Rob.
Well, I mean, underneath, you see, there is an optimist somewhere.
I feel better already.
Just in the right. Well, the other thing that it ties in with, which has been doing a bit of thinking about, and it popped up in kind of, you know how occasionally those one or two words can have a big impact,
and the
nature of character rather than personality or authenticity of personality, that kind of stuff. So the modern, postmodern idea of be the change you want to see in the world, all that rubbish, we've talked about it before. And then your character is something which is kind of, you have to discover about yourself. You really can't change your character. You are who you are. You just have to learn to live with it and get the best out of it. But to do that, you have to have a sense of purpose. What is your sense of purpose? Now, in modern life, very few of us have a sense of purpose. We just want to fit in. We just want to get through the day. We just want to, you know, not be admonished, not be ostracized on LinkedIn. You know, we want at some point to be acknowledged for our social presence. But that's not anywhere equivalent to a sense of purpose. What is, and we never ask this question, you know, it's something that kind of, you walk into the street, we did Vox Pops again in the street, and we turned around to me and said, what's your sense of purpose in life? Most people would say, oh, you know, to pay the rent to get through the day. And it's like,
or the kids or something.
And that might be a purpose. Yeah, I want to pass on a better life to my children or my grandchildren, whatever. That is a sense of, a laudable sense of purpose. But there's other, you know, well, what about you specifically as an individual? Because the danger is you subsume yourself in everybody else's needs and you don't address your own needs, which accords with your character. So some people are highly individualistic and some people are highly family oriented, exactly, you know, and they're your, but at some point you stop being the provider for a family or a workplace that everybody else is dependent on, and because everybody else grows up at some point, and you have to find a new purpose. So your sense of purpose moves and shifts as the social dynamic moves and shifts. Yeah.
Well, that was what I think was quite interesting to watch my father go through when, you know, we all got older. I say all, me and my brother. Brother moved away to London. I've got a job now. He was made redundant after being a journalist for, I want to say, 30, 40 years. So he's, you know, what do I do now? I'll go to university, I'll get a history degree. I think, you know, to change like that and to find a new sense of purpose is actually quite remarkable.
But there is a sense of, you know, that emptiness and that nihilism that we maybe were in danger of falling down the drain of reduced expectations actually can be countered by. And I was on a meeting the other day, which is like I do some work with another university that, you know, external examine and checking their course. They're very good at the process and the administration.
Yeah.
They're less good at giving people a sense of what their purpose is. So, you know, and this seems to be common across a lot of universities post-pandemic, people are stopping and questioning, saying, and what we do is we blame it on mental health. We say, you know, we haven't got, you know, everything's tough, you know, you need to be easy on us, you know, we're you know, it's creating a lot of anxiety, and the anxiety doesn't come from the lack of capability to deal with the challenges of life. It comes from the lack of a sense of purpose that we can do things differently in the future that are better than we've done today.
Yeah.
And that you've got some ownership over that sense of individual and collective purpose. I kind of just, you know, maybe it's a theme to it does rely on a certain amount of optimism, which I'm not good at.
I think, yeah, we're both running low on optimism at the moment, it seems.
Well, this is the
we've
had our caffeine hit, and now it's like kind of we're
levelling back out.
We should have had
again.
A second coffee earlier. Anyway, we've been going for over an hour.
Oh, right.
Any last thoughts?
Last thoughts? No.
Well, we'll do it again in a couple of weeks, and we can add to that.
Last thoughts. I feel slightly more optimistic than when we started, Rob. I feel like this has been therapeutic in some way, shape, or form. I feel ready to go and attack the next couple of weeks of my droll existence.
I'll go for a wander through Leicester in a bit and think, you know, kind of, yes, it's.
I reckon I'll go buy a copy of King Lear.
Find out about the fool.
Exactly. Yeah. Because I seem to be playing his role currently.
Well,
so.
I mean, that's not a bad role to play. No. I mean, and you know, with every sense of purpose, it's identified with a role.
Mm.
You can't have a sense of purpose without saying that. Well, this is the role I'm going to play.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I can't. That's one of the challenges. If you ask me, you know, what I know, what I kind of think I know what my sense of purpose is, which is to try and advocate or facilitate or support, whatever word you want to use, that we use media for social, democratic, purposeful, consciousness raising, enlightenment, human betterment.
Yeah.
I think that sounds, those words that don't come out of my mouth so easily. You know, that there is a purpose.
I saw
there.
You struggling.
I know, because it's like an affirmation, and I'm not very good at giving a positive affirmation. And I've got to switch that gear, because then you kind of say, well, what's the role that defines, you know, how is that embodied? Well, it's embodied in a role. So if you're drawn to the purpose of healing, or if you're drawn to the purpose of teaching, nurturing wisdom, then you embody that in the role of a teacher or a guru or something like that. Whereas I'm not quite sure, you know, I recoil from specifically saying that there's a role here for me with this, but maybe we should be a bit more confident about that. And at the moment, being the fool, the jester, the trickster that points out, you know, in the Emperor's New Clothes, the most important person in the whole of the story is the child that points out the lack of clothes, and you know,
point out that the court is delusional.
Yeah.
And you know, that's an important role, and it, the story's resonant because that needs to be replayed and replayed and replayed continually. Otherwise, we just keep, you know, opening up little management conferences in out of town hotels in near motorways and completely regurgitate that kind of routine.
Oh God!
I thought I could depress you again at the end.
No, that's good. That's a good note to end on. Okay. Yeah.
So, who? What's the best way for people to contact you?
I'm on Twitter under at Clayton Comics with an X on the end.
With an X, and I'm it's robwattermedia.net, and on Twitter and Instagram it's robwmedia. And until next time we'll have a bit more coffee, I think. So we kind of went up and then kind of fell down towards the end, deflated a bit towards the end, but that's not too bad either.
It's always an interesting experiment.
You've been listening to Distraction Therapy with me, Rob Watson. Find out more at robwatsonmedia.net or follow me on Instagram and Twitter at robwmedia.